Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, there are several dozen late 19th century Carpenter Gothic churches still standing in the state.
For historians particularly, it is one thing to be able to look at a photograph and talk about it. It is another to be able to see that building.
We'll discuss media coverage of the Equal Rights Amendment in Florida.
Efforts to bring the ERA before the states for ratification were unsuccessful until 1972, when Congress enacted legislation for the amendment.
And we'll talk about the Black Codes of 1865. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
There's a place dear to me where I'm longing to be with my friends at the old country church. And with mother we went, and our son it was met with my friends at the old country church.
Carpenter Gothic style churches are typically characterized by wooden board and batten siding, pointed stained glass windows, pointed roofs, and spires with bell towers. More than 60 Carpenter Gothic churches were built in North and Central Florida in the second half of the 19th century. Jack Lane is Professor Emeritus of History at Rollins College and has written about Carpenter Gothic churches.
If you see these churches, then you understand that they were built by a community that just had very little money. As it turned out, there was a kind of beauty in its kind of primitiveness.
There are several dozen Carpenter Gothic churches still standing in the state, including Union Congregational Church in Tavares, St. James Episcopal Church in Lake City, St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Palatka, St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Green Cove Springs, St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Merritt Island, All Saints Episcopal Church in Enterprise, and LaGrange Community Church in Titusville.
When you walk into the churches on the inside, they almost look crude because all the beams were exposed. And part of that had to do with not wanting to spend any more money than they had to on these churches. But the other, I think, is that these churches allowed for, rather than having too much ornamentation, allowed for a concentration of the service and the congregation on a particular thing, rather than having a really ornate cathedral where everybody's looking around and paying attention to the architecture.
The principal designer of Carpenter Gothic churches in Florida was 19th century architect Richard Upjohn. He was part of the Gothic Revival movement in America, first building small stone churches. Jack Lane.
He came under the influence of what was known as the Oxford Movement in the late 19th century that began in England. And the Oxford Movement was a kind of restoration of the Gothic style of architecture because they argued that that was by far and away the most amenable to the whole concept of Christian theology. And so if there was a kind of movement which is called ecclesiology, and which they tried to match the church architecture with church liturgy and theology. That movement resulted in a large number of small stone churches being created in England at the time in the Gothic style. The Romanesque had been the most popular in those small churches before this. And then there's some travel of Episcopals in this church over to England. They came back with the knowledge of what was going on there. And so Upjohn, as an architect, was very much influenced by it, and he built larger churches in the Gothic style. So there, Upjohn was part of a Gothic revival in churches in this country.
Richard Upjohn turned from designing stone churches to wooden churches, which worked much better for pioneers in the remote wilderness of Florida.
They were very, very simple to build, so that carpenters, all the carpenter needed was the design that he had presented to them, and they could build it. And so the result was that these little churches started popping up in New England, and later, as we'll see, down into Florida as well.
Bishop John Freeman Young of the Florida Episcopalian Diocese was responsible for most of the Carpenter Gothic churches that were built in the state. Jack Lane.
He had traveled to England. He had become a kind of student of this ecclesiology of the Oxford movement, and was absolutely convinced that these were the kinds of churches that should be built by these communities when they were going to build them. And he traveled throughout the state, making certain in his mind that these congregations understood that these kind of churches were available to them if they wanted to build a church.
Polly Schuster Polk is historian for St. Gabriel's Episcopal Church, built in Titusville in 1887.
John Freeman Young, who was the bishop at the time, it was mostly his mission. He was the bishop of Florida, and he was determined to grow us. And I think what I didn't realize until I started doing a lot of research was he was getting pressure from the National Episcopal Church, and he was trying to prove that he really was working, that he just wasn't, you know, enjoying the sunshine and fishing in Florida. And so they wrote journals. And one of the journals I ran across was from one of his missionaries that he sent down here. And the bishop was trying so hard to prove this that he submitted this priest's journal to the national church. And in this journal, the priest talks about how he started up in Jacksonville. He had to come on the boat down to Enterprise, and then he had to wait, and then he got on another boat, which was called, I believe, the Little Addie, which he makes a comment that it was not designed for transporting people, and he had to sleep outside. It dropped him off at Salt Lake. From there, he walked carrying a valise of prayer books, and he's just kind of walking around being a little evangelist. And so he crossed through what back then would have been very treacherous territory. I mean, it's all swamp and muck and animals. I mean, he said he saw a tiger, but we're pretty sure it was a panther. But anyway, he walked all the way from Salt Lake to LaGrange, where he met up with some of the Carlisle family and made comments about them. They asked him to come back. From there, he walked into Titusville the same day, got here about sunset, because his mission from Bishop Young was to meet with Colonel Titus, because he knew that Colonel Titus was an Episcopalian, and have a service. It sounded like it didn't go that well, because Titus did not ask him to do a service. His name was Reverend McClure. He spent the night, and then the next morning he walked back out to LaGrange and had the first Episcopal service there. He held a morning prayer service at 11 a.m. That was April 20th, 1869. And then from there, he had more things he had to do. He was supposed to go out and see Douglas Dummett. And that, again, he had to navigate the Indian River. And then from there, after Dummett, he had to go up to New Smyrna. So I don't think people really realize what a true frontier that this place really was. I mean, everything was horseback and boats. And when John Freeman Young came back with another priest back in, I think, 1871, and it wasn't any better, he had to come the same way. So these people were determined to spread the word and to get their churches planted.
When you think of Florida architecture, the first styles that come to mind are probably Cracker architecture, Art Deco, or Mediterranean Revival, but several dozen Carpenter Gothic style churches still stand in the state as a quaint reminder of late 19th century Florida history.
For historians particularly, it is one thing to be able to look at a photograph and talk about it. It is another to be able to see that building and to talk about it and to give a kind of sense of what it's like by going in there and getting the feel of it.
We spoke with Jack C. Lane, Professor Emeritus of History at Rollins College, and Polly Schuster Polk at St. Gabriel's Episcopal Church in Titusville.
And the Savior above through his wonderful love saved my soul at the old country church. Precious year is a memory. Oh, what joy. My friends at the old country.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find out about upcoming events, listen to archived editions of this program, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Kimberly Wilmot Voss, a professor of journalism at the University of Central Florida, is well known to many members of the Florida Historical Society and readers of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Her research focuses on women in journalism and reporting on women's issues.
In a 2009 article in the Quarterly, Voss looks at the media reporting of the several efforts by the Florida State Legislature to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. As she states, the study examines the fight leading up to the 1977 defeat of the measure by looking at the media's coverage of the ERA battles, women versus women themes, and Senator Lori Wilson's mediated representation. The Equal Rights Amendment has a long history. First introduced in both houses of Congress in 1923, it was conceived by Alice Paul. A Quaker, suffragist, and leader of the National Women's Party, she was identified as more radical than many of her fellow suffragists, as she adopted the actions of British suffragettes and organized suffrage parades and picketing before the White House in support of the vote for women. Efforts to bring the ERA before the states for ratification were unsuccessful until 1972, when Congress enacted legislation for the amendment. In quick succession, a number of states ratified the amendment, which stated, quote, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex," end quote. Two additional sections gave Congress the power to enforce appropriate legislation supporting the amendment and indicated that the amendment would take effect 2 years after the date of ratification. Florida considered ratification three times in 1972, 1974, and 1977, but failed to ratify the amendment. The ERA inaction mimicked earlier consideration of women's rights. In 1920, Florida did not bring the 19th Amendment for woman suffrage before the legislature for ratification, although several cities already allowed women to vote in local elections. In 1969, the legislature symbolically ratified the 19th Amendment. Voss places her work within the context of previous studies on Florida, the South, and the ERA, but distinguishes her research by focusing on the media in reporting the events and determining the outcomes. By focusing attention on a pivotal figure and casting the battles between women as catfights, she says, the media lost the opportunity to engage in the larger role of explaining the impact of the ERA and facilitating broader public discussion.
The consideration of the ERA was time for serious discussion. Labeling it as a catfight seems unnecessarily derogatory.
It does. As with so many aspects of efforts to ratify the ERA, and similar to the push for the 19th Amendment in 1920, labeling the debates between pro and anti-ERA groups as catfights robbed the moment of its policy importance and relegated it to the realm of screeching noise with few historical implications. The ERA mattered to women on both sides of the issues. Nor was either side entirely unified in its support or opposition. In addition, both sides argued over the methods to be used in the fight. On the pro-ERA side, divisions between the so-called old guard and new guard, that is, women in professional roles who had been involved in earlier feminist fights, and those new to the fight who often arrived through civil rights, stymied the creation of a unified voice for ERA advocates. Some leaders, such as Betty Friedan, were portrayed as divisive and too removed from typical women to represent their views. They agreed, however, that a constitutional amendment was needed to move women from the status of second-class citizens. In many states, women could not own land, obtain a mortgage, or obtain credit in their own name. Until 1968, a Florida woman who wanted to go into business on her own had to petition the court to demonstrate her competence and good character. More unified in their opposition, the anti-ERA arguments focused on concerns that ratification of the amendment would lead to unisex bathrooms, the elimination of alimony, and the legalization of gay marriage. Voss notes that the two reasons most cited for opposition to the ERA were conscription of women into the military service and the breakdown of the family. Citing other studies, Voss notes that in the South, feminism competed for space within the public rhetoric still struggling with issues of race. As an example, she points to claims of anti-family lodged against ERA supporters who advocated government-supported daycare. Opponents claimed the centers created by the ERA would take children away from their families, just as busing had literally taken children away from their families in the process of desegregation.
Connie, how did the media depict these differences and influence the outcome of the ratification?
Voss argues that the language used by the media was condescending and negative. As an example, the women's strike for equality on August 26, 1970, was the largest women's protest in American history to that point. But media coverage focused on throwaway quips by men. Vice President Spiro Agnew noted that three things have been difficult to tame: the oceans, fools, and women. We may soon be able to tame the ocean, but fools and women will take a little longer. On the national level, not all ERA proponents saw the media as unsupportive. Activist Susan Brown Miller, historian Carol Mueller, and journalist David Broder point to the role newspapers and magazines played in highlighting the issues and unifying the forces of ratification. Voss points to the media failure to provide analysis of the amendment and questions the claims by each side as contributing to the state's failure to ratify the ERA. While most newspapers focused on the catfight that erupted between the opposing sides, polls indicated that Floridians supported ratifications by a wide margin. Political figures who claimed that the people of Florida don't want the ERA to pass were not challenged. On the editorial pages, letters for and against ratification were paired, giving the impression that support for the amendment was weaker than the polls indicated. Both the Miami Herald and the St. Petersburg Times championed the ERA, but even there, the support was framed by male journalists, since women played a limited role in the creation of mainstream media messages. In addition to shaping the rhetoric, media focused on personalities rather than messages. The emergence of Gloria Steinem and Phyllis Schlafly provided media with national figures who were articulate and photogenic. In Florida, that role was played by Brevard Senator Lori Wilson. Elected as an independent, she emerged as the sponsor and principal advocate of the ERA in Florida. In a speech before the Senate on April 10, 1974, she tied ratification of the ERA to the nation's history of liberty, but did not move the legislature to ratification. By January 1977, ratification seemed in reach. 18 senators vowed to support ERA and 13 were against, leaving 9 senators undeclared. By April, however, a series of vote switches put ratification in doubt. When the measure failed, Wilson placed the blame on, quote, the good old boys in southern legislatures, but she predicted they were clutching at pseudo-power that will not last. Voss concludes that the blame fell on several actors. The Florida ERA was not well organized and did not spend time debunking anti-ERA myths. But she saves her principal blame for the media, for its failure to analyze the issues or use the polling numbers to question the statements by elected officials that the people did not want the ERA. She also notes that although Senator Wilson commanded the attention of the media, journalists used her image frequently but gave her little airtime. The role of the media, Voss concludes, should be considered as a factor in the defeat of the ERA in the Florida legislature.
It's amazing that this legislation still hasn't become law. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Immediately after the end of the Civil War, Florida enacted a series of laws to limit the freedoms of formerly enslaved people. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Alexander J. Bone is a PhD history student at the University of Georgia. His research interest primarily focuses on the intersection of class, race, and memory in Florida after Reconstruction, particularly how the Lost Cause myth was constructed in Florida and its connections to racial violence in the early 20th century. I spoke with Alexander about his journal article published in the Florida Historical Quarterly titled Made and Executed by the White Race, Florida's Constitution of 1865 and Black Codes. Several factors explain how Florida's Constitution and Black Codes of 1865 were, quote, made and executed by the white race, end quote. First, newly emancipated Black Floridians' integration into the social and economic order clashed with white expectations of a post-war society that maintained their dominance and thus resembled life before the war.
In the aftermath of the war, there's a lot of ambiguity in the air about what's going to happen next, both on the side of white Southerners and Black Southerners alike. For Black Southerners, you see the Union Army rolling into Tallahassee, or the fact that the Confederate Army has been defeated, and you're thinking, okay, well, I must be free. But you do have a good number of Black Floridians that are moving away from their former owners' plantations, and a lot of them are congregating in towns like Tallahassee or Jacksonville or Gainesville. And this is really sort of heightening the fears that white Floridians have about the nadir of postbellum society. This really kind of fueled these concerns about, well, what are Black Floridians going to do now that they're free? Are they going to retaliate and sort of try to do to us what we did to them? So you have a lot of just ambiguity on both sides about what's going to happen next. And this informs what a lot of white lawmakers are trying to construct in the new government in Florida.
The second factor was President Andrew Johnson. His tremendous leniency towards ex-Confederate states' readmission into the Union, primarily seen in the Amnesty Proclamation of May 26, 1865, effectively enabled the recreation of a white man's government in Florida.
The Amnesty Proclamation has a number of consequences as they pertain to the creation of Florida's new government. For one, he's effectively letting ex-Confederates off the hook, at least politically speaking. So you now have ex-Confederates that are able to hold office when there's eventually an election or the election for delegates to the Constitutional Convention. There's also the fact that in a lot of cases, amnesty from the president was also absolving them of participating in the Confederate movement and giving many that had their land confiscated by the U.S. Army back to them. So this is really putting a damper on all this land that was set aside to be given to Black Floridians or Black Southerners is now being given back to their former owners.
As a result of these two primary factors, Florida's Constitution of 1865 contained explicitly racist and discriminatory elements.
The discriminatory elements of the Constitution, there were a good number of them. One, Black people couldn't serve as lawmakers in either the state Senate or the state House. That was reserved just for white men. So you're completely separating Black Floridians from the political process. The apportionment formula that determined how much power different counties and populations of the state would have was still in line with that of the Three-Fifths Compromise, where Black residents of the state were counted at three-fifths of their total, meaning that Black Floridians were not given their full representation in state politics. And lastly, juries were all white men. You had no women, you had no Black men or women. It was just white men.
The Black Codes further augmented the discriminatory elements of the Constitution.
They recommended, and all of these were eventually passed by the state legislature, corporal punishment and involuntary servitude as legitimate sentences for crimes. Vagrancy is criminalized, effectively meaning that if you're not gainfully employed to a white person, if you're a Black person, you are deemed to be a criminal. And that was punishable by up to a year of involuntary servitude. It fully outlawed interracial marriage. It expanded the definition of what a bastard was in connection to the validity of Black marriages to then aid a future apprenticeship law that the state would pass. Effectively, what they were trying to do in that instance was say, if you are not the legal child of a married couple, then you are technically a ward of the state, and then we can sort of pawn you off to white employers up until, I believe, you were either 18 or 21, effectively putting black children into another form of slavery. And lastly, no public assistance or public education for black Floridians. This goes back to the racist perspectives of the members of the Peel Report, and that they didn't believe that black Floridians were prepared for an education. They felt they had to learn their place in society as it currently stood before they could receive an education.
Despite President Andrew Johnson facilitating the regeneration of a white man's government in Florida, the Constitution of 1865 and its adjacent black codes were ultimately rejected by Congress. Its flagrant and egregious disregard for their standards of readmission, such as universal male suffrage, enraged the radical Republicans of the Reconstructionist Congress.
Republicans in Congress, they were not having any of it. I mean, Florida in itself, as I argued, was their black codes and their constitution were just as vehemently racist as Mississippi and South Carolina's. But by the time that the decision was made by Republicans in Congress that we needed to just take the reins of Reconstruction and throw out these constitutions created by white Southerners who were overwhelmingly ex-Confederates, Congress was just at the point where they're like, we can't depend on them to do anything. They're just going to try to reinstall slavery as best they can. So I think Florida was a piece of that puzzle.
Alexander points to this early draft of Florida's Constitution during Reconstruction as a striking indicator of Florida's active Southern identity after and beyond the Civil War.
This account of the Black Codes and the state constitution in Florida just demonstrates that from a very early point, the state was committed to a white supremacist society. Obviously, that was the case before the Civil War. Florida was a slave state. It was one of the earliest members of the Southern states to secede and join the Confederacy. But this sort of sets the tone for what's going to happen in the later years and decades in Florida, namely the fact that when Reconstruction's over in 1877, Florida creates a Jim Crow institution. They disenfranchise black Floridians with the poll tax, install elements of public segregation. And then as I see in the early 20th century, and as I'm aiming to study in my dissertation, you see extra legal means of maintaining white supremacy and lynchings and race massacres in the state at sites like Ocoee and Rosewood, Perry, Newberry, etc.
To learn more about the Florida Constitution and Black Codes of 1865, please listen to my entire conversation with Alexander J. Bowen on the Florida Historical Quarterly podcast, available online at the UCF Stars Library. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us on Facebook at Florida Historical Society and online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.